You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Talk is Jericho, baby.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll and movies, as one of my favorite guests, Eli Roth, returns to Talk is Jericho with his brother Gabe and film editor Mark Goldblatt. They join me today to talk about slasher movies. Yeah, this is an education in the genre. And as always, when Eli is on, you know you're going to get tons of cool trivia about movies and the filmmaking process. So today we're talking about the films that create and define the entire slasher brand, starting with old Italian slasher movies to movies like the original Halloween, Friday the 13th, Psycho, the Argento movies, and why the whole genre died off in the 90s. Eli's got some great stories, as always, about how some of the earlier films were made, how the killer point of view was created, and the effect that the assassination of President Reagan attempt in 1981 had on the whole genre. We'll also get the slasher movie revival in the late 90s. You'll hear some of our favorite films, plot lines, favorite death scenes, favorite murder weapons, all that great stuff. Slasher movies with Eli and Gabe Roth and Mark Goldblatt is coming up. But first, new book is almost here. No is a four-letter word, coming out August 29th. But I want you to pre-order it now at my Amazon store, amazon.com/shop/IamJericho. The book is The 20 Principles of How I Made My Dreams Come True and How You Can Do It as Well. It's going to help you attain all the goals that you have for your life, tell you how I did it. Pre-order it now on Amazon. And if you haven't downloaded the new Podcast One app, what are you waiting for? Just hit us up on the App Store or Google Play and download the app. Start watching all the amazing 360 virtual reality videos. There's over 1,000 of them on the app. You'll feel like you're right there in the studio with your favorite podcasts. And the app also lets you interact with other podcast fans and access behind-the-scenes contact. Very, very cool. There's none of the podcast app like it available. Download it now and get to exploring all the cool special features. Also, don't forget about my Friends of Jericho shirt, available at represent.com/Friends of Jericho. Get one of the coolest designs that I've thought of so far and help support the fight against juvenile diabetes. Go to represent.com/Friends of Jericho to check that out. And also, I'm about to hit the road with Fozzy for another round of dates on the Judas Rising tour right here in the United States. We're going out with Gemini Syndrome and The Stir next month. That starts September 26th in Clarksville, Tennessee. Take the last train to Clarksville. September 27th, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Then we got Columbus, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, Libertyville, Illinois, Janesville, Wisconsin, Buffalo, Niagara Falls, New York, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Worcester, Massachusetts, Wilmington, Delaware, Wilmington, North Carolina, and, of course, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And then we're going all the way overseas to Europe. October 27th, we are going out with Hardcore Superstar in the UK and Europe, Birmingham, England, Dublin, Belfast, Ireland, Chester, Manchester, London, Sheffield, Glasgow, Newcastle, all in the UK. Then we head over the pond to Amsterdam, Aschaffenburg, Pratteln, Roncade, Rome, Vienna, Munich, Essen, Hamburg, Genk. And also we're doing VIP meet and greets and pre-show mini concerts for all of those dates. It's one of the best VIP packages you can get in the business. Come meet the band. Come take some pictures with us and actually see us play a set of songs that you probably won't hear in concert before the show. You can do all that at FozzyRock.com. Look up the tickets for the gigs as well. Come hang out with us. All right, it's going to be a rockin' fall. Speaking of rockin', Judas. All right. Down to number 2 this week on Octane. Biggins Countdown, not too bad, but top 20 still on the active rock radio charts, and also nominated for the best hard rock song of the year at the Loudwire Awards. Huge stuff going on with Judas. The record comes out October 13th, but for right now, let's hear the song Judas on Talk Is Jericho.
On the inside, you are innocence personified, and I will drag you down and sell you out. Run away. I am cold like December snow. I have carved out this soul made of stone, and I will drag.
And roll song, and a great, great guest today is Eli Roth returns with his brother Gabe and film editor Mark Goldblatt. They're going to be here to talk slasher films, but first I got another tour to mention, and that's Diamond Dallas Page's DDP UK tour. Dally is bringing his crazy stories, over-the-top motivation, hilarious Q&A, and DDP Yoga Live workshops to the UK starting September 8th. You'll be able to meet Dallas, take a selfie with him, and even have him sign an autograph or two for for you. So join in on the inspiration meets perspiration and experience Dallas's infectious energy for yourself. Go to ddpuktour.com to reserve your spot. Get all the details. That's ddpuktour.com. He's also doing DDP yoga workshops in Glasgow, Manchester, Birmingham, and London. And if Dallas isn't going to be in a city near you anytime soon, get the DDP Yoga Now app and get on the track to healthier living. You know what DDP Yoga has done for me in my career. I've got the DDP Yoga Now app on my phone. I just open the bad boy up. I do a workout whenever I am, wherever I am. Over 150 workouts on the app, as well as the opportunity to do live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center in Smyrna, Georgia. And DDP Yoga can help you get in shape and live a healthier life as well. Dallas has thought of everything because he truly cares about everyone. He wants everyone to live a healthier life and meet all of your fitness goals. And his DDP Yoga program is great for anyone and everyone, any age, any skill level. And with the app, you can track your progress, get nutrition tips, recipes, and all the motivation you need to stick with the program and stay on your game plan. So Diamond Dallas Page, once again, made it so easy for you to get on board his life-changing program just like I did. Take advantage of this tremendous deal that Dallas is offering. He's giving you 20% off the DDP Yoga Now app and all DDPY merch, swag, clothing, etc. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. That's ddpyoga.com/Jericho. It's time to own your life. Start today. Get in the best physical and mental shape you've ever been in and do it now.
Talk is Jericho.
Okay, hot on the heels after the hugely successful 80s teen sex comedy discussion with the Roth brothers. They're back, Eli and Gabe, and also editor extraordinaire Mark Goldblatt is here. And we're going to talk today about another huge genre that was more prevalent in the 80s. We're talking about the 80s slasher films. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Eli Roth being the savant of all things movies, what's the genesis of the slasher film, starting basically late 70s, early 80s?
Well, there's an era that's commonly referred to as the golden era of slashers, which kind of begins with Halloween in 1978.
Right.
And it sort of dies around Friday the 13th, part 4 or 5.
So, which know, was 86?
Yeah, like 86, it's kind of a dead genre. People think that like sort of 70, really kind of 78 Halloween to Nightmare on Elm Street in 84... A lot of people pronounce sort of Reanimator as 1985 as the end of the golden age, because what happened was home video exploded and people realized that you didn't have to put these movies in theaters. They would make so much money on VHS and therefore they didn't really have to be that good. So whereas Halloween was very much, you know, about Laurie and the characters and Michael Myers and the mythology, they just realized eventually that people just want to see kids just get mutilated. It was like, what's the killer? What are the weapons? And really, Friday the 13th, part 3, is kind of an amazing movie. Because first of all, it's in 3D.
Of course.
But it's the first movie to take it to a 3. When that movie happened...
Oh, interesting.
No one had thought, because it was like, well, Michael Myers died. And I should say that Mark Goldblatt edited Halloween 2.
So he's got real street cred.
We're going to have some real stories about directing, yeah. You know, editing, working on the sequel to the seminal movie, the genre. But really, by part 3, they sort of realized, well, it's Jason. He can just keep coming back from the dead. That had never been done before. Up until that point, it was like The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby and The Shining. And a horror movie had to have logic and make sense.
But that's a great point. That was the first one to have a number 3, out of any movie.
Out of any of them. Because it also, that's when he gets the hockey mask in. In the first one, it's the mom. The second one, it's the baghead. And that's Marty Cotrozer, who's the script supervisor on Inglourious Basterds, wrote the screenplay with his wife. And Quentin told me, he was like, you know, Marty created the hockey mask. And Jason, in the middle of the movie, he kills someone. He's looking around. He puts on the hockey mask. Once the mask came on,
wow,
that was it.
The legend has begun.
Yeah.
Right.
Very cool.
Which I did not realize, because you're right. He was the baghead. Just put that on. You can hold that there. He was the baghead in number 2, wasn't he?
Yeah. So now once he's got the mask on, well, he can just kind of keep coming back from the dead. So when you do part four, they're like, okay, now it's like just get a bunch of kids there, and what weapon can we kill them with? So it was no longer about what's scary. Also, it's sort of an interesting time in culture because. And we'll start from the beginning and go through this. But there was a huge backlash against the violence. And sort of Jack Valenti, who was the head of the Motion Picture Association of America, was in charge kind of metering the violence. The turning point is 1981, when it was the Reagan assassination attempt.
Hmm.
When Reagan was shot, they said, this violence has to stop. The violence is out of control. And the first movie to get it was My Bloody Valentine. My Bloody Valentine is a way more violent movie, and the MPAA ripped the film to shreds.
Cut it to shreds, yeah.
Cut it to shreds.
They finally re-released the director's cut on DVD some years back.
They did, and a lot of the scenes were lost.
Because as a teenager, going to the local video store and finding the comic book rack of horror movies, and My Bloody Valentine was one of those ones, and you watch it and nothing happens. Because like you said, all the good scenes had been cut.
Yeah.
But you don't realize that when you're a kid. You're just thinking, this sucks.
You might know this. What about the Video Nasties in the UK? Did that start before?
The Video Nasties started in 1983 with Evil Dead, where what happened was, at first, I mean, I know we're completely jumping out of order, but the Video Nasties was the whole thing in the UK where certain movies were banned, and it was Evil Dead. Sam Raimi was brought up on obscenity charges in the UK, and apparently the court trial was so traumatic that he went and he did Crime Wave, but Evil Dead 2 is comedic on purpose because of the backlash to the violence. Same thing with John Carpenter after he made The Thing, was called a pornographer of violence. So after The Thing, he follows it up with Starman, which is this kind of science fiction romantic
interesting
comedy. Because, and trust me, I know what you know it's like to be labeled like
that. I was going
to
say, you've had the same.
I've had the same thing happen, which I'm
label.
Obviously very proud of. I mean, it's hard to do these days. So, but it really, you know, if you look at the history of the slashers have always been kind of the uncontrollable id of society, that darkest part of, you know, the worst things that you can think of. When someone cuts you off in traffic, there's a party that wants to ram their car. It's like the slasher, many different metaphors. But it sort of started in Fritz Lang's M with Peter Lorre, the child murderer. And the big one is Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960. That is like the turning point that changes the genre. But it's sort of, you know, Roman Polanski kind of becomes the big horror, you know, the thriller director with Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
And Repulsion. But then after his wife is brutally murdered, obviously by the Manson family, he kind of takes a step. And that's when the Italians step in, Mario Bava. And what's happening in Italy is interesting relationship back and forth between Italian and American cinema. If you look at the American Westerns, then the Italians decided they were going to do their version with spaghetti Westerns. Well, they create on-screen violence. You know, if you think of High Noon, the guy gets shot and grabs his chest. But if you look at the Sergio Corbucci movies and Sergio Leone films, though, you know,
there's blood packs galore.
Because no one was telling them not to. So then what happens is all of those writers of the Westerns start moving over into crime movies. And there were paperback pulp crime novels that were prevalent in Italy with yellow covers. And the word for yellow in Italy is giallo.
Giallo.
So as Mark knows, this whole subgenre starts with directors like Mario Bava and Dario Argento, where they take these kind of pulp novels, or they'll adapt them or write their own. And a big one that crossed over in 1970 was The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. And that has a lot of the tropes. The knife, generally a killer wearing black gloves, knife penetrating a young woman, which obviously in Carol Clover's
book, point of view as well.
Operatic,
like the
stylistic vision.
Yep.
Argento was very operatic.
Very operatic. And by operatic, we mean over-the-top colors, like minimal. Like you'll see a whole shot of a square and just hear the sound of heels. The music is way more dramatic. They're very, very Italian. But they didn't. I remember as kids when you watch the first Italian movie I saw that I didn't know was Italian was Demons. Because no one tells you. It's direct,
sure.
Because they changed the names on it, so there's no Italian
for
credits.
For me, it was Suspiria.
Suspiria.
Same thing. You don't know that it's Italian, but you just see a little bit weird dubbing, but some really, really unsettling images. That opening scene
Suspiria
where
Suspiria was very remarkable because it was different from anything that had come before.
I'd never seen it.
Even for Argento.
I still remember that scene with
it?
All the...
Did you just say
no, I said we'd never seen it at the time.
Yeah.
Okay. What I still remember from being a 13-year-old, 12-year-old was the giant fat maggots in the attic, and it's like falling down.
Falling into the razor wire.
Everybody falling on the grill.
That
on the floor.
And the opening scene where the person gets dropped through the chandelier, like
amazing. Spectacular imagery.
But you had never seen
there was
anything
no frame
like
of
that
reference
before,
for that.
Right?
It was just like insanity.
Let me just jump in quickly before you're talking about Psycho in 1960. How did that movie get made with how strict the laws were and the morals of the time? They must have run Hitchcock through the coals for that.
There's a huge...
Well, there was a backlash. A lot of critics really slammed him. It's interesting how these great pivotal horror films that certainly happened again with Peeping Tom, which was around about the same time.
Yeah, same year.
I mean,
Hitchcock
Powell's career was like torpedoed.
Yeah.
In England, he had to go to Australia to make movies.
Welcome McDowell?
No,
Michael Powell.
Michael Powell.
The director of Peeping Tom.
Great Michael Powell, director of Black Narcissus.
Gotcha. So you're talking about there was ruining these guys' careers.
There's a great movie the Hitchcock one with Anthony Hopkins with Helen Mirren playing his wife, talking about how she came in and recut the movie and rescored it. Like, nobody liked Psycho. He paid for it himself. It was like Hitchcock was going to go bankrupt when he made that movie. He used his TV crew. He shot it in black and white.
Right.
It was like, it was, he shot it for $800,000, and Paramount, they, or Universal, they wouldn't release it. So he put it in, he let them, dude, they let him put it in like two cinemas, and he put up a big thing, warning, Psycho is the scariest experience. Do not see this if you have a heart condition. Did like, and it was selling out and selling out, and then it became a classic, but they, the studio didn't even want to release it.
It was so bad.
Hostile, they weren't going to release. Like people saw it, and they're like, this is so violent, no one will see this movie. And then we did a test screening, and audiences were like screaming, and then Quentin came on board, and they released it. But that was the same thing, that reaction. Not that it's, I'm not comparing it to Psycho, I'm just saying,
you're going
through
the same
thing. Like, anytime you try to push the envelope that way, people are like, audiences won't accept this.
You get demonized.
Right. No pun intended.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
So the slasher films, you know, Mario Bava, there's a film that everyone, the well that everyone's drinking from is a film called Bay of Blood, which also has the title Twitch of the Death Nerve.
Love it.
That's from 1971. Excellent movie. It's released on DVD. That's where the POV gets created.
Okay, that's where it was.
The killer POV.
Killer POV.
And all of the deaths Steve Miner says he took for Friday the 13th Part 2, you can put it on top of Bay of Blood.
Yeah, well, Sean Cunningham. Yep. Also was highly influenced by for the first Friday the 13th.
Where they have sex and it gets the...
Stabbed through the body,
To both bodies get stabbed. That's straight out of Bay of Blood.
Yeah, it's Mario Bava.
Wow.
No, it's true. So Bay of Blood is a great film, but then that POV, Bob Clark, this is how Bob Clark is such a genius. The guy creates the slasher holiday genre with Black Christmas. Then he invents the sex comedy with
Porky's.
And follows it up with A Christmas Story. A movie that is played 24 hours at a time.
Talk about an underrated genius, right?
He started a zombie movie, The Children Shouldn't Play With Dead Things, and did this amazing kind of zombie vampire hybrid film called Death Dream in 1974.
Which is political, right?
Really political movie. Someone comes back from Vietnam the night Andy came home. It was the original title. It's an amazing film, but it's about a mother's wish for a dead son. They get the news the son died, and the mom just does this prayer going, please let him be alive, please, it's not true. And then he shows up, and he just seems weird and won't leave his room. And then they find out that he's going out and drinking blood, and that she brought him back. In the end of the movie, they drive to the cemetery, and it's the mother, he buries himself, and the mom helps bury him. It's like, you get chills watching this movie. It's so smart. Bob Clark was such a genius. So he does this movie in Canada. Canadians, big influence on slasher films. He does this movie, Black Christmas, and he was going to do Black Halloween. He was just going to change the holidays, but it's a slasher POV watching the girls. It's Margot Kidder. Mm-hmm. The girls in a sorority house over Christmas that have stayed there are getting stalked by a slasher, and it's terrific.
It was somewhere in the building.
Yeah.
But they don't know where, but we know where, I think. It's in the attic.
You see the killer in there.
And then, you know.
He was doing that before When a Stranger Calls, right?
Yeah. It was before When a Stranger Calls, Fred
wasn't
Walton.
It before Halloween?
Halloween was 1978. So John Carpenter has a script called The Babysitter Murders that he's going to make, and they change it to, they change the title to Halloween.
And he did that after Assault on Precinct 13, which gave him some cred.
Yeah, for sure. And Dark Star, one of my favorite movies.
So, Mark, you edited Halloween 2.
Tell us about that.
Because Halloween's such a pioneering movie, and 2 does hold up, but what was your experience with that?
Well, John Carpenter did not direct that. It was directed by Rick Rosenthal, whose style is somewhat different.
Why did Carpenter not direct it?
I guess he didn't want to.
Okay.
He pre-produced it with Deborah Hill, and they were very close to the project and very hands-on.
Mm-hmm. Was he there? Was he involved in the production or the editing?
He was involved in the editing for sure. He had instincts. He had good ideas, and...
But the pressure to follow up Halloween.
One of the things that was different was that there was actually more overt gore and violence than actually appeared in the first Halloween.
Yeah, the first one
more TNA as well.
Right? We had the razor blade in the kid's mouth.
Yeah,
which was a cool one. We had the donkey murder by
topless nurse getting dunked into the boiling water,
the hot tub,
which is
eviscerating the skin. Which again, we said. Comes from Profondo Rosso.
Deep red. A great Dario Argento. If you want to get the Argento, let's talk about... Okay, so there are a lot of people that are going to listen to this that might know, I saw the Friday the 13th remake. You don't want to go too hardcore. I don't want to go start with strip nude for your killer. What is a good gateway drug, Argento 101, that people can watch if they're not super into Italian movies? What are like two movies that you can like... I would say Deep Red and Suspiria.
Suspiria, yeah.
And sure. But Deep Red is the eye in the closet that's directly out of Saw. If you talk to James Wan and Lee Whannell, they were watching Seven and Argento. I mean, this whole movie's a tribute to Argento. And right. And for me, Hostel 2, the upside down kind of bloodbath of the late Elizabeth Bathory scene, that's my Argento sequence. Mm. I mean, you want to go a little, then you can go to Tenebrae, but I think Suspiria is such an amazing movie, and
Suspiria stands alone, and it's not even, there's no tradition for it. And I guess the idea was that Argento got the idea from his wife about the witches.
Dario Nicolodi's mother. Dario Nicolodi's mother went to a ballet school in Germany that was run by witches. The entire thing.
For real.
Wow. And it was witches and the killings and the girls disappearing.
The three mothers.
The whole thing came from his wife, Daria Nicolodi, Ozzy's mother. That was the grandmother, had been through this experience and told Dario. And so he wrote the movie about it.
Based on that.
So the other thing is that in Italy, people have to understand that during World War II, when, you know, Mussolini was the one who built the film industry, and, you know, the Nazis were making their movies, the Italians were making propaganda movies, but Mussolini, the way they sort of controlled the information was that you weren't allowed to record sync sound. Now, sync sound is when the camera's going and you're talking and you recorded the picture and sound separately, but you're not allowed to do that in Italy. So they built studios that were by the airports. They're very noisy. And the reason they were not allowed to was because you'd have an officer from the government in the dubbing stage listening to everything you're recording.
Really?
So that the government could supervise every single line that's being used. So you couldn't put any anti-fascist propaganda, anything anti-Mussolini.
Wow.
So what happened was, after basically 8-10 years of this, people got used to it. So the Italians, then when they start making movies for the rest of the world, what they would do is they would have Italian actors, German actors, French actors. They did this in the spaghetti westerns. Everybody speaks their own language, and then afterwards they have like three people dub them. So you're like and they would change the name of the directors, so all these Italian directors had their Americanized, you know, Bob Robertson was Antonio Margheriti was Anthony Dawson.
Margheriti.
So none of these guys, you know, they all, you'll see them with like, you know, really weird, a very sort of plain American names. But that's why you just have to kind of accept it as one of the things. It wasn't really until Gangs of New York that they soundproofed the sound stages. So it was that late in the game that they made Cinecittà soundproof. So the dubbing, we all associate it with kind of bad kung fu movies and bad dubbing. But if you just, you kind of, to enjoy these movies, you have to sort of get over that and not make fun of it and just go, just kind of watch it for the colors and the creativity in it. It's just how it was watching J-horror.
Once you get used to the fact that there's, you know, writing at the bottom of the screen, you know, you just take it and you don't even notice it anymore. You know, once you get the subtitles that are there, same thing with these giallo and the bad dubbing. You just kind of, it's like listening to Metallica saying Anger. Just forget about how bad the drum sound is and just listen to it for what it is, and you actually can get into
it. It's true.
And love it.
Yeah.
No, it really is.
No, you have to stop making fun of it and not be on a pedestal about
exactly.
Listening to it. Which is something that people kind of innately do.
It's
when
a
they
convention.
Hear
it's like rear projection. Or miniatures in a Hitchcock film.
Yeah.
You watch the miniature train and the lady vanishes.
That's the best they had.
It's great.
Sure.
I love it.
You just accept it.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
This is Talk is Jericho.
Let me ask you this, Mark. We're talking about, you know, we're kind of moving into the 80s. Now, Halloween is a 70s movie. I think Halloween 2 was 80. And you mentioned how there was a lot more violence and gore and, of course, a lot of sex in 2. Is that just a sign of the times? What's that?
Well, was it a sign of the times? Yes. Of course, in a slasher film or a horror film, you probably want to get away with as much as you can because you're trying to break through taboos. I mean, that's part of it. There's something very transgressive about a horror film.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can talk about things in metaphor that have a greater import and have to do with society and things like that. So, but Grand Guignol, the influence of Grand Guignol, to me, is a very powerful force. You know, people always denigrate this stuff, but it's kind of a mosaic of blood.
Sardou.
Grand Guignol was in Paris, the Grand Guignol Theater in the 1890s. Yeah, macabre, and they would do live executions. And people, all Paris high society would show up. And they would pull off these effects that people still don't know how they did. And there were theories, was it real or not? But it was theater. It was like theater of blood. People would show up to see. And that, of course, is what Bloodsucking Freaks is based on.
Completely.
Yeah.
With my boy Ralphus.
Ralphus, the greatest.
Ralphus. So when did you're talking about, let's say, you know, heavy metal started with the Steppenwolf song, Heavy Metal Thunder. What slasher films? When did that term start being used?
Halloween is made for $300,000 and makes $40 million at the box office. Now, that's like that's Star Wars numbers. That's a movie that's in the theaters for a year. Mm-hmm. So suddenly every studio is like, well, wait a minute. Why are we spending all these money on big budget productions? We can start cranking them out. So then Sean Cunningham makes Friday the 13th, and that one explodes. And then they start looking at Halloween. Charles Kaufman's like, well, let's do Mother's Day. Like, they just looked at the calendar. That's why I did.
Wasn't Friday the 13th and Halloween and Mother's Day exactly
they were
the same
filmed
time,
at like, the same time across the lake from one another?
You know, wow.
And the casts would hang out and like,
you think have all the holidays been taken?
Well, that's why I did Thanksgiving. That's one holiday. We grew in Massachusetts where
what about all the Jewish holidays? I think they're still available.
Wait, by the way, we want to do the Simchas Torah massacre, the Log Bomer burning.
The Yom Kippur killings.
But then they start moving. Movies like The Burning, there's a whole subgenre of early 80s slasher films that are filmed at overnight camp. But I grew up in the East Coast and I went to overnight camp. And from June to August, they're booked up in camp. So to film a movie there, they either have to film it in May or September. So there's a great convention in movies like The Burning where you can tell it's like really, really cold outside. There's no leaves on the trees and everyone's in jeans. And so the swimming scene, these poor kids are like turning blue and it's like, scram, squirt, it's going to be long summer for you. And they're like, and then the kids go in the water and you just like, they just turn into human icicles. It's so sad. But like those early 80s movies.
After Friday the 13th, and suddenly there's a million camp
Madman has them, yeah.
Sleepaway Camp.
Sleepaway Camp.
Madman has The Burning.
Sleepaway Camp, there were like three of those? Or
there was
four?
Three.
Four.
Well, there was
Sleepaway Camp is a fantastic
And I'm going to throw two in there as well for an 80s time capsule slasher fun movie. It's great. Three, horrible. Terrible.
But other good movies like
Terror Train. Well,
Terror Train is a great one. Roger Spottiswood directed that. There's a great book called Men, Women, and Chainsaws by a woman named Carol Clover who really came up with the final girl theory. Mm-hmm. And that the movies, she broke down. There were enough of these films that she said these are about men, that it's about their impotence, the killer's impotence, and that's why they're penetrating the women. And if you look at Pieces, you know, it's about this man who's, you know,
classic.
It's like there's the one middle piece of the puzzle of the naked woman and the relationship with the boy's mother. And he's now building a human jigsaw puzzle. But every time he comes in the chainsaw in the silhouette, it's like a giant dick. It's an erection. It's literally he's penetrating the women. So
they were saying that all the serial killers couldn't get it up.
That's what it is. It's all the men's anger at women and their frustration of the women being more like they're amazing, amazing essays There's actually a really terrific magazine called Axe Wound. This girl Hannah runs that, where she deconstructs April Fool's Day. Like there are these amazing kind of female horror fans that deconstruct this stuff like you would not believe. And what she came up with was the final girl theory. And the final girl, there was even a movie about it called Final Girls that's on iTunes, where that's the last girl in a horror movie and she's almost always the virgin. And of course, it wasn't until Scream came out that there were so many movies that people were self-aware of that they could self-consciously follow the rules, make jokes, and then break the rules. Like, oh, we have sex now I'm going to get killed. But she pointed out that it's always the virginal one that is the last one, and she's the one that lives to the next film and usually is the one that gets the kill. And that was Jamie Lee Curtis.
Was subtly saying that she's a virgin, she's better than everyone else. Like, she's nicer. She's the hero.
She's pure.
She's pure.
She's
exactly.
pure. She hasn't been tainted. Sex is bad.
Isn't that kind of the irony, though, of, like, the early 80s when it was, like, Republicans are in charge and everything, and it's like they were so against these movies, but these movies themselves are kind of like Republican propaganda. Like, don't have sex, right?
I know.
And Tipper Gore, you know, heavy metal guy right here, like, Tipper Gore, she was a pain in the ass for movies.
You're seeing the rise of heavy metal, punk rock, and slasher movies and sex comedies at the same time. And meanwhile, on television, you're not allowed to have sex. Cable TV isn't mainstream, so the only place you could see it was the titillation, it was the taboo of mixing sex and violence and sexual violence. And then it was after the Reagan assassination they really started pulling back, but you still got movies like The Prowler that slipped through. And then, you know, as what happened was horror. You had Philip Kaufman making Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You had who's doing the right stuff. You had Stanley Kubrick coming off of Barry Lyndon doing The Shining. You have Spielberg, you know, Jaws being Oscar nominated. Like, making a horror movie was a thing that, like, Ridley Scott doing Alien, like A-list directors did. Then the slashers came in, and some of them are great, but a lot of them are, I love them, but they're not great movies. Mm-hmm. So good directors kind of stayed away from them. They sort of became associated with being B movies and bad movies.
But like you said, then you start watching them just to see what kind of deaths you can come up with, what kind of inventive demise.
Inventive ways to get done.
Right, and that was, you know, because we used to do a thing, I told you about the Cheap Ass Club, which I just asked your advice for this Christmas, where you would rent the movie and you would watch it, and if for every boob that showed up, you'd take some points off. And if there was ever a dick, you'd take some points off. If there was a great death... So you'd start at $4 for the rental and then take money off. And if you got to zero, you knew you had a hit. And if you got minus, then we owe them more money. It was so great.
What about, like, De Palma, though?
De Palma, we can talk about De Palma. De Palma sort of fills a void where Hitchcock, whether it's Hitchcock or Polanski doing the thrillers. I mean, De Palma does Sisters and then he does Phantom of the Paradise and it's not a big box office hit. But De Palma, it seems like he's, you know, he kind of comes into his own when it's Scarface and The Untouchables.
Body Double is like a straight up.
But he does. Yeah. But I don't know. You got to know how. It's hard to know how much he loves the genre. I don't know.
Well, he loves the tropes. He loves working with.
He loves the cinematic quality of them. I mean,
does he love the film noir? It's not
because
so much a slasher.
A film like Blowout starts with the greatest fake slasher movie. But it's like he doesn't commit to making a slasher. He has to make fun of a slasher. Now, De Palma's one of my gods of cinema. I've said this with, like, Carrie is one of the most incredible horror movies. But he's doing these elevated, but he's always going for this kind of dress-to-kill psychosexual thriller. And even in Body Double, the porno elements are the movie within the movie. It's like he never fully commits to making a porn film. He does a scene where they're shooting a porn film. But the drill penetrating in Body Double was notorious. That, like, people couldn't, they had never seen anything,
never
like,
seen anything
it.
Like that before.
So, yeah, I mean,
Dress to Kill is basically also, though, isn't it? That's also a slasher movie.
Yes, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
For sure.
But, you know, there's something about De Palma, which, because he's an auteur, we'll say he's an auteur, I think it's fair to say, his style is discernible from other styles. Right. So you always know you're watching a De Palma film, and he brings something to the table and it's very, very precise.
But they're different from his early political stuff. I'm going to do a whole De Palma talk. Yeah. If you want to see the most, like, the best De Palma movie, I think, is High Mom from 1970 with Robert De Niro. It has a sequence where you're watching it and it's like this goofy comedy that's totally insane. What's that?
Jill Clayburgh in that one?
No, it's Jennifer Salt, Robert De Niro, Alan Garfield. It's amazing. Garrett Graham. And it's a sequel, a quasi-sequel to Greetings, where a guy comes back from Vietnam and he's obsessed with Peeping Tom and porn and, like, filming his neighbors. And Robert De Niro wants to make porn movies. And then there's a sequence where he gets involved with these Black Panther radicals in this production called Be Black Baby. And it's the craziest 10 minutes of cinema you've ever seen. And it's actually, you leave the movie with your jaw on the ground and you can't believe.
You don't know what you just saw.
You don't know what you just saw. It's like human centipede level, what the
f- Right.
Brilliant.
But let's talk about some of those moments in some of these movies that we discussed, some of the classics. Like you mentioned before, Pieces, one of the greatest endings
ever
of all time, where he actually ends up making the body. So what he's doing, he's killing people, killing girls, and then making his own jigsaw corpse, basically.
Yes.
But at the end of Pieces, what happens, Eli?
Well, I don't know. I feel like spoiler alert.
It's been 30 years. The spoiler is statute of limitations is over.
Edmund Purdom has been putting the bodies. It's like one of these guys that was like the handsome British actor that was then working in Spain because he couldn't work anywhere else. And they're still like dyeing his hair and playing him off like he's in his 50s. But Edmund Purdom is making the body. And of course, he's caught by the police, and he's got the tennis instructor who's the police officer undercover, and he's giving her the drug that paralyzes her. And then the hero, played by Ian Serra, it's an amazing film because it's Kendall Morgan, the campus stud, this guy that's f***ed every girl. And at the end, he's like, oh, hang on, I forgot my jacket. And it's like they think the killer's dead. And then the body falls out in slow motion. It's this amazing shock of the body falling down. And they're like, oh, my God, you've seen like every single person that's been killed has been mit. And then he's standing there. And then out of nowhere, the f***ing hand reaches up and rips his dick off.
Rips his cock off. And like the dead corpse and rips his cock off.
And actually, I had like a very interesting conversation with a friend of Quentin's, this woman, Ada, who really broke it down. And she said that was actually a brilliant ending because it's about all of the anger. The women are pieces of meat to this guy. This guy, every single person in the movie, he just sort of fucks them and forgets them. And that this is the rage of the women at this asshole that are literally ripping his piece out. And it's interesting. The director, Juan Piquer Simon, who directed an amazing movie called Slugs later in 1988,
we saw that the other
day. Was like an openly gay director in probably like late 70s. I mean, it was like he was not a young guy when he made that film. And clearly, you know, there was growing up in Catholic Spain and fascist times and what he must have been through, like all of these feelings about women and his mother. It's one of those movies that you can't dismiss. You can write it off as a piece of shit horror movie, and the more I watch it over and over and over, the more like appreciate. Like Mother's Day is one of those films where you could say, okay, this is a movie about these two like hillbillies that are like, you know, raping and murdering, you know, women in the woods and the Pine Barrens in New Jersey. And then you look at it closer, and I've talked about this with Guillermo del Toro, it's this incredible sort of deconstruction of the overflow of pop, the sewer of pop culture. And the two guys are named Ike and Adley, of, you know, Ike and Adley Stevenson. Like it's like there's political commentary. And I actually met, you know, Charles Kaufman, and did a screening and asked about all that. And Warren Light, his co-writer, went on to be a very successful playwright. Like when these guys made the slasher film, they're like, what if we do like a very kind of smart comment on all the garbage of pop culture? And they filmed fake commercials for the movie. So if you're watching all these like fake products and all this shit, it's like they just saw all, it's like, it's amazing.
TV's
like
always
all,
on.
TV's always on. Mm, it's right. Like, it's like all the stuff that these guys
TV, yeah.
kind of see. He's killed by the television. He's killed by the That's breast.
Right. Did he get Drano poured down his throat yeah. first?
And an axe yeah. in the
balls. Starts puking yeah. Yeah, but pink then
the
blood.
Breast, the breast suffocates a mother's breast. It's yeah. like these guys are very specific. You know,
yeah, that's how the mother dies, yeah.
And George mm-hmm. Romero, when he's making Night of the Living Dead, zombies, you know, zombies were kind of a metaphor for slavery. In the 40s, it was the mad scientist that wants the slaves, so they would hypnotize them. But then George Romero, Night of the Living Dead, makes a real strong comment about racism. You know, he puts the black guy as the lead in the horror movie. That had never been done. That was not done. That was like a big thing. And he sort of, these zombies become this thing where there is no race. They're just like, anyone will eat. And all the stuff that he was commenting on, what was going on politically in 1968 for that movie to come out, it was like this flare that gets sent up into American culture. And then by the time he does Dawn of the Dead, he just sees consumerism, people consuming, going to the mall and buying and
it's
buying.
The mall, right?
And that's why he sets it at a mall. It's like he always used zombies for some kind of political metaphor. It's like Tobe Hooper when he does Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Psycho, which were both inspired by Ed Gein. I mean, Ed Gein at the time in 1959, this was a guy in Wisconsin that was like killing women, wearing their skin, keeping his mother's corpse in his house. Mm-hmm. This shocked.
That's
this.
Real. Yeah.
That's real. And that shocked America. That had never been discovered.
All the photographs were in Life magazine. Mm-hmm. You ever see that issue of Life magazine?
Oh, no.
That's what made it national news. Oh. You know, lampshades made out of human skin.
Yeah. Well, all this kind of Holocaust stuff was happening at home for wow. this guy had been beaten. So you get like Don't Go in the House is an Ed Gein story. Deranged is an Ed Gein story. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And Tobe Hooper's like, you know, he grew up, he's like, I grew up with the Norman Rockwell American family, but now the Manson family. You can't underestimate the power of what That's Charles right. Manson right. and those horrible, horrible murders did to American society. No one thought that this was possible. And so,
that, right.
so there's like a turning point where it starts to come out in the movies, you know, and it filters it. So getting back to the Italians, the way the Italians, the Westerns, these spaghetti westerns sort of added violence. The Italians did these crime giallo movies, and at the same time, Commedia Sexuale Italiana, these crazy Italian sex comedies where there's always an old guy and like the hot young girl, and he walks into her in the shower and they're chasing him around. They're super rapey movies, but they're very, very funny. But it's like the precursor to the American slasher film and the sex comedies. We sort of look to those guys and start drinking from over their well and bring it over here.
It's interesting. The same directors would do both kinds of movies. Lucio Fulci did a couple of those comedies as well.
Fulci did some amazing.
Talking about with Bob Clark as well. You're very diverse as a filmmaker, making comedies, horror movies, holiday movies, and they're all great.
Right.
But the Italians take it next level. Like if the Americans are trying to make a movie for mainstream, you'd see like the Italians. Like when Lucio Fulci commits, he does New York Ripper, and that movie's like. That is like switchblade in the pussy level. You're like, oh, like stuff that's so sick and so crazy. Yeah. He just like, they'll commit to it. And they're like, that's what the movie is.
We talked
that's
about
a
the
duck, right?
Oh, that's Don't Torture a Duck. Oh, yeah.
No, New York Ripper.
New York Ripper, yeah.
Yeah, he's like.
The killer talks to the duck.
Yeah, you're either down with the duck or you're not down with the duck. If you're not down with the duck, you're not going to like them. That's like a
movie. The killer talks like a duck is what we're saying.
Yeah, he keeps falling in to like taunt the police.
The police
like,
guess where I am, Lieutenant.
It's like it's one of the weirdest movies ever, but one of my favorites.
It's unique.
Go ahead, Gabe.
Well, I was gonna say there's this weird sort of thing that happens. Like all the movies you're talking about are like these kind of intense movies, and especially in the late 70s and the very first movies. Like I'm sure you're about to get into Prowler and things like that. But then in the mid 80s, like early mid 80s, it gets a little silly. You know, like in pieces, it's kind of funny. Like there's funny scenes.
Oh,
and, like,
yeah.
It's written, and then like Motel Hell, and you just get to this point where it's like oversaturation, and it's like that's the fun of those 80s. As opposed to the early 80s,
the Mutilator. They're not rough. They're not brutal. They have a sense of humor about them, which is sort of what killed the genre.
But the thing is, too, though, and also I think another thing that killed the genre is that the killers became way more interesting than the victims. So you became much more entranced in what the killer was doing and how he was going to kill these idiot school kids or teenagers. Mm-hmm. And that kind of – that took away the fear and made it fun.
How many kids dress up? Like Freddy Krueger. Like Freddy Krueger is iconic. Everybody loves Freddy Krueger, but you forget like Freddy Krueger was like a child rapist.
Yes.
Yeah, he was
like Freddy Krueger was like a
movie.
Pedophile
who was
like,
burned who was by the families of
the kids he molested and killed. It's like it's unbelievable. But you know, we've gotten so far away. What happened was the popular movies of the day, the real blockbusters became the Schwarzenegger movies. And every time as Mark Goldblatt, our editor of Commando, where's Solly? I let him go.
Right, then it becomes a cliche.
One of the classic lines of movies, I let him go. And I remember, like, did the idea that, because Rambo was pretty silent, but when Schwarzenegger came in, he made a joke.
He had punchlines.
So you waited for the punchline. So then suddenly Freddy Krueger's like, don't lose your head, have a nice day. And because Freddy could talk, Freddy becomes really funny, so he's hosting television shows, Freddy's Nightmares.
Freddy raps with the Fat Boys.
Like he did rap.
He does.
Freddy raps with the Fat Boys.
Yes, between the Dream Warriors Dokken and between Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, the theme song to one of the Nightmare on Elm Street, I think it was part 4, is him rapping with the Fat Boys.
And let's not forget Love Kills by Vinnie Vincent Invasion, which was also...
By the way, can we also give credit to the Italians because they were the first ones that introduced electric guitar to Westerns. Like if you watch the Clint Eastwood, Sergio Leone spaghetti Westerns, like the way that Italians made it cool and modern and hip, which nobody appreciated at the time, people made fun of, they weren't using an orchestra. They were using an electric guitar to score a movie. That had never been done before.
Right.
Italians did it. Dario Argento, again, in Phenomena, 1985, scores it with Iron Maiden.
Right.
It was released as Creepers over here, and you were like, oh my God.
And they flashed the blade.
They flashed the blade.
I believe Saxon also made an appearance in that as well.
Yes. like the Italians were just like, yeah, we'll put heavy metal. Like, mixing heavy metal and horror, the Italians, Mario Bob, it's demons, it's...
But once again, as kids growing up in the 80s, you go look at the video store, and it's like, it's a horror movie with Iron Maiden in it. I'm sold. I remember the movie
Jennifer
being
Connelly.
Shit, because it was probably edited to hell.
Jennifer Connelly.
Jennifer Connelly, 13 years old. If there's a remaster of it, if Phenomena, it's been released as, it was called Creepers when I was a kid, beautifully photographed. Jennifer Connelly at 12 or 13 years old, it's like... It's like Natalie Portman, The Professional. Her acting is so good. It's like unbelievable.
And it's a terrific movie.
Yeah, but wasn't that
very underrated when it came out?
Very underrated.
But wasn't it also edited all the good scenes out of it?
Yes, because always did that to his movies.
That's what I mean. It would suck because you wouldn't get to see.
It wasn't until DVD came out in like to the 2000s that you could finally start to see how beautifully these films were shot and see the uncut versions. Same thing with Lucio Fulci, The Beyond, City of Living Dead, which is called The Gates of Hell. They would retitle it. They would cut it down. So the slasher movie kind of goes dormant. You get movies like The Mutilator, which was released originally titled Fall Break, so it has a great theme song going on a Fall Break. Finally, Amazon Prime
finally
has the uncut version, and it is brutal.
Because you even suggested that we rent that for the cheap ass club, and it's like, make sure you get the unrated version. And we thought we had the unrated version, but it was still cut. So Amazon Prime now has it up there, and it one of the worst scenes with the hook going up the vagina, up the coming out the stomach, and it's just like
you're like, what?
She's this like literally getting hooked like it's a fish.
It's horrible,
terrible.
And yet you gotta admire Bloody Buddy Cooper,
Bloody Buddy Cooper,
who directed that one movie. And I took my bifurcation in Cabin Fever. My working title was Fall Break, and me getting ripped in half was my nod.
No, explain bifurcation.
Bifurcation is when you were ripped in half, like Omen 2, where the elevator cable cuts you, and also the cable at the beginning of Ghost Ship. And really, you know,
Friday the 13th, doesn't he, when they're having sex, he splits it right in half.
Yeah. Bifurcation. I was obsessed with it. I love the name Bifurcation.
And you were it must be a death metal band out there somewhere called Bifurcation.
It's like defenestration. The act of being thrown out a window is another favorite word. Like with this movie, I always say, like, can we just put a defenestration just to use the word? But so by the end of that, when they're straight to video, like they're, you know, kind of by 86, you know, you Friday the 13th part 5. It's like they just start running out of steam. And so people kind of stop doing them. The Freddies kind of die. And it really isn't until Scream that
Didn't they send Jason into outer space?
Jason went to hell. Jason went to space.
Jason fought Freddy Krueger.
Freddy versus Jason. But that was 2003. That was the year the R-rated movies came back. But it was 96. It was really when Scream comes out, that is. And what's so smart about Kevin Williamson, and he does it in television, like at the same time he does Dawson's Creek and he does Scream, and this guy is just like his voice.
Again, diversity.
He takes the John Hughes approach. He's like, I'm going to write, because what happened was the teens were so dumb in these slasher movies that the antidote was John Hughes. And John Hughes comes in and he says, I'm going to make teens smart. He does what Cameron Crowe does in Fast Times. They're not dependent on their parents. Mm-hmm. I'm going to treat teenagers like adults. I'm going to tell real stories, and audiences devoured it. Suddenly, and I remember being like, everyone else was into The Breakfast Club at a sleepover, and they were all watching this movie, and I was bored out of my mind. I appreciate it now, but I was bored out of my mind. And then I put on Reanimator, and like everyone left the room, and I was like not allowed at parties anymore. I was still in it. I was like not catching up with the time.
That was the thing about having sleepover parties at our house. Like I remember for my 10th birthday party, it was literally like I wanted to watch Motel Hell, but in order to do that, I had to tell everyone, okay, we're going to watch Nighthawks because it has Lando Calrissian and Rambo in it.
Yeah.
And so we did a double feature, and I was like, okay, we'll do Nighthawks, and then we'll do Motel Hell, and it like took like that sort of easing in.
Audiences wanted smarter characters with their teenagers, and that's just the evolution. It's not good or bad. It is. Things come in waves, and so the slasher, it goes. There's a whole documentary, The Rise and Fall of the Slasher Film. It's like it's over. It ends. People don't want to pay money to see it. The VHSs aren't selling, and then kind of by the 90s, it's a dead genre, and still the MPAA is pulling back on violence, and you have like Bush and Dan Quayle and all these people that sort of as a demonstration of how we're going to protect society, they pull back on movie violence as always, and then it really was Wes Craven and Scream, and Craven does Last House on the Left in 1972, a seminal movie that is the kind of serial killer movie. Then he reinvents the slasher film with Freddy Krueger, who can kill you in your dreams. So with Nightmare on Elm Street, and then he starts Scream. I mean, this guy creates three monster seminal genres, franchises. The guy was unbelievable. There's no one like him.
Let's talk about some of your favorite movies from that time frame. I'm sure you have some that stand out for you.
Yeah, you know, the movies that I go back to, Pieces, is probably my all-time favorite slasher movie. If you want to pair it with a good double bill, Torso by Sergio Martino is another
good. Torso was quite good.
Jigsaw puzzle giallo from 73.
Yeah.
But I love The Prowler. The Prowler is just like a good nuts and bolts, like meat and potatoes, good nudity. Tom Savini does amazing effects in that film. There's like a great pitchfork death. And Farley Granger is in it, who is, I think, you know, banging Heather Thomas at the time. That was a rumor, and I just had the utmost admiration because I was obsessed with Heather Thomas.
Prowler has the single best 1-2 punch between the bayonet going down the guy's skull straight into the pitchfork scene. In the pitchfork scene, it's a very long shot of a woman naked showering. She's hot, and it looks like they just really killed someone. The effects are so amazing.
Well, there were things like in Maniac is another one, and this is Tom Savini, the shotgun blast to the head where you could fire live rounds, which you can't do anymore. Like, there was no safety or protection laws, so the shotgun blast, and he had been in Vietnam, and so he knew weapons and knew makeup effects, so he would build a head. He does it in the opening of Dawn of the Dead when they kick open the door and the police are in that crazy raid, which is always one of the weirdest scenes. There's like a zombie outbreak, but there's like racist police breaking into a private building. I'm like, this is so weird, but that's what makes it so amazing. And the shoot, you see the guy, they nicknamed him Boris. It's like a very famous guy in like an orange and yellow shirt and his head gets blown. That's because they could use real shotguns to do this stuff.
So they would actually set up the dummy and then use an actual shotgun to blow it up.
That's why the headshot in Maniac, that's why the end of the Prowler, and that's why Dawn of the Dead looks so amazing, those headshots.
Because they're really blown up.
Because he was really blown up.
I had Tom on the show, and he said, I said, what's your favorite death you ever orchestrated? He mentioned that one, the Maniac head explosion.
So I love those. For me, it was like Maniac, the Prowler, the Mother's Day. But Mother's Day, I watch at my bar mitzvah. That film was like, you know, and I saw like we had like cousins from Larchmont that were traumatized by that movie. But that movie I've watched over and over and over and over. I think it's like a subversive.
So would people come over to your house because you guys were allowed to watch whatever you wanted at your house?
We had a Pieces poster up on the wall in our basement. It was next to our WWF poster and a Pieces poster. And the other movie that we
watched
a lot. That
poster is now in my house, by the way. I had it professionally restored by an art restorer. I'm not kidding.
Nice. Well, the other movie we watched a lot was Student Bodies.
Ooh.
God, is that a good movie?
Student Bodies was great. It's a comedy.
Directed by Mickey Rose, Mickey Rose, who co-wrote Take the Money and Run. And it has like an Alan Smithy credit. It was basically scary movie. It's like a parody of slasher films.
It was one of the first ones, wasn't it?
It was so funny. I love that movie. As a kid, as 10 years old, like that thing making fun of slasher movies and the body count was like, it was hilarious.
But I would disqualify those type of movies. I didn't like comedy horror movies.
Seen Student Bodies?
I have seen it, but I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying, but I didn't like Night of the Living Dead. We want brains. Send more cops. I didn't like that. Return of the Living Dead. I didn't like that. I don't want comedy.
You don't want pizza with your steak.
What about Motel?
You like it separate.
I want one or the other. Huh?
Did you like Motel Hell?
Yeah, but that's not so much a comedy. That's a dark comedy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's totally consistent. No, I know what you mean. I mean, that's where American Werewolf in London, the tagline, it said a comedy with bite. It was sold as a comedy.
Dark comedy,
that's
right?
That's said on the poster, because it was funny. But the idea, I always thought the humor, and I remember a lot of people were like, Cabin Fever's not scary, it's funny. I remember like that part of me, I like it when the humor comes from the horrificness of the situation. But I made a conscious decision in Hostel to like fully shut
But there's a difference between...
Shut it off.
Cabin Fever's not a comedy. It's got some funny parts to it, as most good movies do. But when it gets rolling, it's pretty
it's
pretty disgusting
movie.
And dark. Yeah, absolutely. I never had an issue with that as being in that style.
But no, I agree with it. But that's why when the kind of the Freddy's, the Jason, those movies, they stopped it. It's
become parodies of themselves.
Yeah, and then there were some bad ones in like kind of post Scream. Then there was I Know What You Did Last Summer, and then there's the PG-13 where all the TV stars would do it, but they wouldn't take their tops off. So you had a slasher movie with no nudity in it because
that's the death knell.
Exactly.
It is. Offensive.
One would do it. And then so then you get movies like that. Then there was Urban Legend. Mm-hmm. And then Valentine, Jamie Blanks, who does Urban Legend.
They start going to the Final Destination, and they're bringing it back.
Although, you know what? The Final Destination was great. Destination was like a good...
They actually had a good run.
Especially Final Destination 2. Yeah. I thought the truck crash. David Ellis' truck crash. And that was
With the log and everything.
The log
was great.
Really, really one of my favorite sequences.
But when you're talking about, like, you know the Freddy and the Jason, those movies, because you mentioned before that Halloween 2, then you get Friday 13th 3, and then they're going 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And I remember the one, I think it was Jason Takes Manhattan, where he's up on the rooftop boxing somebody, and then the guy's like, come on, throw your best punch, and then Jason punches his head off. He hits him so hard, his head just goes boop, and that's where to me it's just like bad.
Well, no one was trying. There was nothing clever about it. No, they weren't trying to be scary. There's no audience for that. It's like, oh, people love Jason. They don't have to be good. And that's when you get, you know, the guys like, you know, when it was James Wan, Rob Zombie, and Alex Aja, and Neil Marshall, and all the guys that were like, no, we really care about Greg McLean. Like, we care about making these movies great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Ben Wheatley, like people that actually are like, no, you can have really good acting, really good stories. And then you see stuff that's coming out now, like It Follows, which is kind of the modern slasher movie. It's so damn smart. Or even this kind of
House
new way.
House of the Devil.
House of the Devil by Ty West is fantastic. Even The Witch, Robert Eggers' film The Witch, is so good and smart. And, you know, then you see, I don't want to ruin it, kind of, I won't, but Split is amazing. It's like
I'm caring about that.
Oh, it's amazing. I won't say anything. It's such a
just go see it.
It's such a return to form for, it's like, it's fantastic, but it's like just smart, scary. So there are people, you know, the thing is, I love a good kind of trashy slasher film, but these movies in the 80s, they weren't trying to be bad movies. You felt like by the time Fred Jason's punching off, they don't care if it's good. It's like, oh, it's okay. It's a Jason movie. It doesn't have to try. And then, you know, yesterday they were trying to reboot it. The reboot got shut down.
Again, another
yesterday.
Friday?
Yeah,
Friday. Another Friday, Friday.
They're rebooting it.
Because they already did one.
They did one. I don't know why. I have no idea why. I think it was because Rings didn't do as well as people thought it would.
Like a totally different kind of thing.
I know.
I think that's a really good point that you just made, though. That it's like Mad Men we were talking about earlier. It's like, you could tell they weren't trying to make a bad movie. They really cared about it, and there's something about that earnestness.
They might not
that,
have had the
resonates.
Money to make,
You know what I mean? And
about
like
a passion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you know, some people are passionate about whatever they do. Other people may not have that passion.
Well, I think it's like rock and like heavy metal in the 80s too, and the late 80s. That's why grunge came, because it just became a parody of itself, where there were so many bands getting signed, and also even the great bands were starting to get lazy. You know, think of like Maiden in the late 80s.
Well, everyone thought it was never going to end.
Right.
That's what happens. Like, you know? It's just that easy. You didn't have to do it.
Because when you think back to like Friday the 13th, like, there's some terrifying, like when she's stuck in the outhouse and they start that's terrifying.
They are, you know, we can talk about, you know, Sean Cunningham and Steve Miner took from Mario Bava, but those guys are fantastic. Those are fantastic.
Remember like, was it the two guys, the leather guys? A rat a tat a tat a tat a dooey. I'm gonna kick your ass. I'm gonna kick your ass. You really fucked up this time, asshole.
That's pretty good. Yeah. You got to cover some of the theme songs of these movies. Like there's a great trope in these movies that they do in My Bloody Valentine, where they tell in the Mad Men, where the closing credits is the ballad that tells the story of the movie you've just seen. They're like,
you must remember some
ago in a place known as Henniger Mine, but he's good. Women legend began. It's the ballad of Harry Warner, but he's so Canadian. It's like, of the horror of long time ago.
It's like Gordon Lightfoot or something.
It is like when we were shooting Glorious Bastards, Quentin and I would play. We actually had it on a loop. The Ballad of Harry Warden.
Who was the killer in My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah, exactly.
In Mad Men, there's two songs to open the movie. There's a guy telling the story, and then like this, someone sings the song, and then at the end credits, there's another song about everything. It's like,
I love 80s slasher campfires with the guy. That's why I put one in Cabin Fever, like Phantasm. It's like monsters with bell bottoms in the cemetery. It's the best.
I like the random, like a Sleepaway Camp 2, where it opens up with an Anvil song. For like 10 seconds of just like no reason, which when I was talking to Lips, I told him that he had no idea.
You know,
no idea he was even like, what? What are you talking about? Really? We're in it? Oh, that's cool.
I always felt bad for like, there's always like the fat guy that wasn't getting laid, like who's kind of has to wander off on his own. And like, it's like, that's like kind of the one guy that won't be paired up with a hot girl or that gets rejected or tries to hook up. It's like, God damn it. And then he kind of goes off. Well, by his own advice, I'm like horrible.
But your theory of fat guy, cool guy, nerd not only exists in teen sex comedies, it exists in slasher movies as well.
It does. It's true.
You know, you really have the same dynamic.
That's the one case where the virgin doesn't survive. The fat guy is always going to get hit in the horror movie.
It was funny because Jimmy DiBello in Cabin Fever was our fat guy. We're like, okay, we have these two couples and these two couples, and that's the purpose of the fifth wheel. The fat, or like, it's the guy that just isn't going to get laid, so he just goes around doing really stupid shit that gets everyone killed. Basically.
Was it Friday the 13th 4 where there's that fat kid Joey eating the chocolate and then the guy just freaks out and murders him? Didn't that happen? Is it 4?
I forget that.
I think, remember, like, it's at the very beginning, he's eating too much chocolate and the guy just flips out and kills Joey, the fat kid. And this is before
Jason even shows up.
It's like a delinquent camp. Then the ambulance guy shows up.
Yeah.
And we find out later that he is the fat guy's dad and he's the killer for that
film.
He's
the killer for that
film. Voorhees was rarely the killer in any of these movies.
Voorhees is like, why is everyone blaming me for this?
I was the killer
in
one movie.
Who got attacked. They tried to kill me.
Yeah, I was the killer in one movie.
My favorite death in Friday the 13th Part 2 was when the guy in the wheelchair.
Oh,
I don't know why it was funny. at the funniest thing, he just gets fucking stabbed in the face. Number 81, Steve, just goes down the stairs.
He's wearing a shirt that says 81.
Yeah, number 81, which I've tried to replicate numerous times, and I almost named my production company like Steve 81. Like, I've always tried to work that into a movie somewhere. When he gets into it, like, I was like, I was laughing so hard. I'll play that over and over and over. The guy in the wheelchair getting stabbed in the face, rolling down the stairs, and then he's rolling there. And then I looked him up to put him in a movie, and it was like, oh, he died of AIDS.
Oh, geez.
So then I felt terrible about it.
Yeah.
I did feel, but until now, being with you guys sort of makes it okay because we're not laughing that he died
but
of AIDS.
But I am laughing at the
we're
fact.
We're laughing at the guy. That the,
when he was going down the stairs, he's like,
it was like Franklin in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I was like, anytime you put a wheelchair guy in a wheelchair in a horror movie, I'm like, no, get out of this movie. I'm immensely dreading. It's like when I see a dog, I don't want the dog to die. If I see someone in a wheelchair, I'm just waiting for the moment that everyone's like, run! And the guy just becomes fodder, like just to delay,
falling
just so everyone else can get away. It's so sad.
It's great, too, though, because you mentioned the sequels, and then other movies from the 70s would come back. Like, remember Psycho 2? Psycho's in 1960. Psycho 2 comes out like 1987. Now Norman Bates is just a garden variety slasher.
Yes.
Like just killing chicks in
directed
a hotel.
Directed by Richard Franklin, who does this amazing movie called Road Games with Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah.
And Stacey Keach.
Wow.
Grant
Goodeve.
No, he's the guy who plays, he's in Stunt Rock. He's like the stunt guy from Stunt Rock. He's the killer in this Australian stunt guy.
It's like an Outback movie where two
Page.
Americans randomly
meet. Yeah.
But it's really good. Okay. And so Richard Franklin, okay, the director of Psycho 2, when he's a film student at USC, is like this kid who's obsessed with Psycho to another level, like the way the director of Toy Story 3 is obsessed with The Shining, the way I'm obsessed with Mother's Day. Like, he's next level obsessed with this. And he fucking calls Hitchcock in his office and said, would you like to come down to film school? May I interview you? And Hitchcock says, okay. So fucking Hitchcock goes down to USC, and Richard Franklin is like, okay, here's my report on Alfred Hitchcock. Like, basically interviews him in front of like the film school and like gets this incredible interview and like dedicates his life and like says he wants to make a thriller, does a really good job with Road Games. And they're like, who can direct Psycho 2? It's like, well, who literally knows the movie? Nobody knows more about this movie than Richard Franklin. Hitch is his idol, and he just, like, he did a great thriller, so yeah, let's give it to him.
And he got
That's how he directs Psycho 2. It's crazy.
I think they even squeezed a Psycho 3 out of it, They did, right?
Anthony Perkins directed one of them.
Now, you caught Exorcist 3.
Exorcist The Beginning.
The Beginning. Oh, not Exorcist 3, Legion. Exorcist The Beginning. Was that the Rennie Harlan? Was it the
Harlan version.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
Because that was reaching, it was like Paul Schrader.
Paul Schrader made a movie, but the studio didn't like it for whatever reason. They wanted more scares, more jump scares, more.
And did you cut Schrader's?
No, I did not.
You cut the new ones, bring in Rennie Harlan.
When I was hired for the job, Rennie asked me to come in, and he said he was going to shoot a little additional footage just to punch it up. Then he got the idea that for the money they were going to spend, he went out on a limb and said, I'll shoot a whole new movie. And we'll just take the exterior shots from the Schrader picture and use them because they had extensive location work in Morocco. So what we did was we went to Rome, and we had Vittorio Storaro again. So he shot the Schrader version, and he shot our version too.
Storaro shot it.
So Rennie Harlan directed Exorcist 3?
Exorcist 4.
Exorcist 4. Oh my gosh. I had no idea.
You know. I mean, come on. You're going to make an Exorcist sequel. It's already in deep shit.
Yeah, right. You're going down the line.
Yeah, John Borman couldn't pull it off.
I like the John Borman film, but, you know, don't be expecting a horror movie.
Yeah. I mean, the greatest theme song ever.
What is it?
Just look up Exorcist to the Heretic trailer, and there's this, like, a trailer with a full theme song. It's the most nuts Ennio Morricone. Like,
of all time.
Totally freaking insane. Because
they also did another one of those is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 and 3, which were like 20 years after the original.
2 is not two, bad.
2 is a good movie.
But it came years after the original.
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, it got cut up for an hour.
And they would always do that. Let's talk about...
2 had the Breakfast Club poster.
That's right.
Yeah.
Let's talk about famous people that made their debuts in slasher films.
Well, you're The Burning. Go for it, Eli.
Holly Hunter in The Burning.
Holly Hunter in The Burning and Jason Alexander in The Burning and Fisher Stevens in The Burning.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Jason Alexander with hair. Fisher Stevens getting his fingers chopped off.
Wow. How does Jason Alexander bite it?
First of all, he looks like he's 40. Even though he's like, kids, get in the water. Hurry up. Crowley's coming. It's like it's Costanza in a horror movie. The best thing is the Miramax, you know, Harvey Weinstein and Bob Weinstein. And, of course, won many Oscars, very prolific, you know, film movie moguls. That's their first movie. It says a Miramax production, but and I always tease them about this because they had no idea what order credit should go in. So it's like The Burning, art directed by, first assistant director, based on a concept by Harvey Weinstein, gaffer, all in the head credits. It's like literally two people that have never made a movie before with no idea whatsoever. And
you
Bob created
movie,
Dimension. That's why he loves slasher films. They released Clown. And that's, you know, he made Scream. Okay. 1408 and stuff. So they love this, but their first thing was a horror movie. So obviously, Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, great Friday. Death. The spear through the throat.
Yeah. Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Was it Nightmare 1?
And that's when he was out in L.A. to be in a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
Wasn't getting any gigs, so tried out for this movie thing, and that worked out okay for him.
Great death. One of the better deaths.
Amazing death.
What is his death?
His death, he's in bed. And he gets like sucked into the bed. It's like a geyser of his blood.
Yeah, and apparently it was crazy to shoot that. They didn't anticipate how much blood would move, and they couldn't get him down. They couldn't. The blood got too heavy. They couldn't rotate the set. He was stuck there for about 15 minutes. Like that was apparently a crazy one. Yeah, Brad Pitt. What movie? What slasher film did he make his movie debut in?
April Fool's Day.
Nope.
It's one of those
Little later. I mean,
prom night.
Little later. Yeah. No, not prom night. Jamie Lee Curtis, Leslie Nielsen.
Who was he in? Student Bodies? It's some teacher.
Cutting Class. You're right, Cutting Class. It's great. It's terrible. Do you know there's a really good Spanish one called Edge of the Axe that starts using like future supercomputers as the subplot. It's like it's almost like Texas Instrument computers run amok. It's like it's you can find it on YouTube. It's a Spanish
who
film.
Made who
it's really really bad.
So how does amazing. Brad Pitt die in Cutting Class?
I forget his. I think I can't remember if he's the killer. If he gets, he's like the popular asshole who gets killed.
Mm.
I forget Brad's death in Cutting Class. I saw it a long, long time ago. I saw it like shortly after.
I'm still can't get Jason Alexander out of my mind.
Those kids run, and all the kids are freezing because it's like obviously being shot in October, but the kids have to wear shorts, so the counselors are wearing
probably
sweatshirts.
One of the best endings, also though, on The Burning.
Yeah, The Burning is a very good ending.
How does ending in that? I've seen it one time.
No, The Burning is the kids are going out to the raft. They think they've made it. They're like canoeing out, and then Cropsy comes up with his garden shears and just like starts mutilating everyone one by one. And they're just like
in the water.
Yeah, they're like in a boat out on the raft. It's like it's crazy, and it's just like this like just barrage at the right at the end of the movie, and then it's like
the end. Yeah. Done. Yeah. There was always the twist too in the 80s slasher movies.
Carrie with the hand coming through the grave,
a classic,
gets the jump, and that's like the big thing. And then like Crowley. Halloween, there's like a jump. You know, there's a Michael Myers is gone. Like you always need and the biggest jump ever was Friday the 13th. I think that's what made that movie. That last shot.
Once again, she's on the boat. She's in the raft.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
In the water.
And Jason, it's been the mom. It was, you know, Betsy Palmer that was the killer. So she's been taking away. She's looking at the ambulances. She's there drifting in the canoe. And it's just still one of the greatest shots in movies of, you know, Jason Voorhees pops up out.
And what's that guy's name? Ari Levine or something?
Yeah, something
Ari
like
Lehman. And he sells that picture at Comic-Cons.
All the time, it's like,
that doesn't even look like you, man.
Anything.
You can't, that doesn't count.
It could be anybody.
How do I know it's you? Another great twist ending was Sleepaway Camp, where we're talking about
Sleepaway Camp with the greatest
Angela Baker,
ever.
Who ends up, she's actually a boy. She has a penis.
They showed a little boy's,
Well, they put his, you know, Angela... They used an 18-year-old, very skinny boy and sort of superimposed her head, and it was so convincing.
It looked so creepy, too.
I screamed so loud when I watched Sleepaway Camp. I was like, she has a penis! Like, I couldn't.
And it's demonic, like, wolf face,
You could never get away with that movie
today. Never. Well, even some of the deaths, there's the beehive locked in the outhouse with the beehive boil. Getting eaten alive where you're taking a dump ski by the bees.
It's true. I always thought water boil was a cop-out death. Like, if I saw boiling water, I was like,
especially when he's reaching, he's like, "Well, let me just grab this thing here."
And you see their face bubbling.
And he's holding.
I always wanted like a chainsaw ripping someone or something to like really crush someone's head. Those are my.
Well,
favorite.
You would get those like Mutilator, where he cuts the guy in pieces with the outboard motor. Yeah. That was a good one.
There was a good outboard motor death in Dr. Butcher, M.D.
Dr. Butcher.
Medical Deviant, also known as Zombie Holocaust, with Ian McCullough, which used the same sets as Lucio Fulci's Zombie. There was a great wave of those kind of Italian zombie movies that came in at this, you know, at the same time, like that's where I think, you know, you got to realize that drive-in theaters were playing movies like Zombie and Gates of Hell, and they weren't even going to the ratings board. Mm-hmm. They were just like, and there were theaters in 42nd Street. That's where the term grindhouse came from. These grindhouse theaters mm-hmm. that were showing movies like Cannibal Ferox, Make Them Die Slowly, New York Ripper. These movies with like really insane Italian violence. They were not putting those movies for the ratings board. And when Wes Craven made Last House on the Left, Sean Cunningham, the producer, took another movie and literally physically cut the R rating because he had to put it on your movie. You would get a rating from the ratings board, but they would be a piece of film that says rated R. So he literally took a piece of scissors and just cut it onto his movie. And that was it.
Cut it onto his movie or cut it out of his movie?
He took the print of the movie. He took a print. They were getting an X. He took another movie. He took a scissors, physically chopped it off, took splicing tape, spliced it on his movie, and showed it in theaters.
It's R. Like a Bruno it says right there.
It says right there. Exactly. No one was saying no. It was like that disorganized. There was no computer system for it.
Sure. Of course.
So a lot of these movies was sort of like when it came to video, the great kind of equalizer in the mid-80s, the video explosion of like 84, 85, when VCRs became cheap and it wasn't $300 for videotape and the price of rental houses, you know, suddenly video stores popped up in the mid 80s. All of these movies, it was like, oh my God, you know, the violence in Reanimator, they would just get released as unrated. They weren't even going to the ratings mm-hmm. board, and they could find an audience in drive-ins and on home video.
So that Joe Bob Briggs would always do the drive-in
theater.
He had his books of all the reviews, like 7 boobs, 1 dink and 5 deaths.
By the way, a lot more relevant to me than like Gene Siskel like saying don't go see Friday
Roger
13th,
Ebert, Gene Siskel. Like, they would trash these movies.
Yeah, like they like gave out Betsy Palmer's like address saying like send her hate mail and
really?
Saying, like, Gene Siskel did. Like it's crazy. Like and they were so shitty.
You know what happened
movies.
To him? He died. No, I'm just saying. I'm not giving out Betsy Palmer's address, and I know where she lives.
So spoiler alert, Siskel died.
Spoiler alert, he died.
Actually, so he was giving out her address?
I think so.
It's because they hated horror movies. You know what happened to Roger Ebert?
He died.
I'm just saying.
Spoiler alert, Ebert and Siskel died.
You know what?
Roger Ebert actually had written a diatribe against the original Night of the Living Dead when it came out. It was published in Reader's Digest magazine.
Yeah, he also
which wrote, I read when it came out.
Geez. But he also wrote
the intro to one of his books was The Case Against David Lynch. And but you know what? He wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which
that's
was
right.
Movie.
He wrote Beyond the Valley,
which
of the
is a great movie.
It is a great movie.
So as we wind down here, we've talked a lot about pieces, great film. Which ones do you guys stand out as your favorites from the genre?
I gotta say, you know, I go back for like my childhood is Mother's Day, but the movie I watch and I've shown it at Tarantino's Theater, the New Beverly, to a packed house, and it brings the house down. My favorite movie is Pieces. It just delivers on every level. And if I have like a party at my house, I'll put that movie on, and you can walk in at any point in the movie and know what's going on, and it's enjoyable. It never loses its entertainment value. It gets funnier and more enjoyable the more time you see it. I love that movie.
Great fun.
It's got everything you're looking for in a cheap ass, you know,
Spanish
slasher
horror
film.
Movie dream the American.
Yeah. For me, like if I want like something kick ass, it's Prowler. For something fun, it's got to be either Pieces or Motel Hell. But Pieces for sure, I think it's above that. I mean, it's its own thing. It's incredible.
How about you, Mark?
Well, there's so many, but my classical favorite is Mario Bava's 1964 film Blood and Black Lace, especially if you can see the new Blu-ray disc in which they got back to the original look of the saturated colors. Mm. It's a marvelous film, very much a classical mystery. But it's got the first of the trench coat, hat-wearing mysterious murderers. You don't know who they are. And some still pretty nasty
stuff.
Set in the fashion world.
Really cool 60s Italian fashion. The models being stocked at a fashion show.
That's right.
Really ahead of its time. Such a unique, interesting setting.
And because
beautifully
it was Bava,
photographed.
You know, Bava was able to take a $49 budget and turn it into a spectacle film. Mm-hmm. And the visuals are just magnificent. I mean, he creates a whole fashion studio that looks like it's cut out of cardboard.
Mm-hmm. And his son Lamberto Bava directed Demons.
Demons, yeah. Right.
That was my favorite. But I would also say Dario Argento and Tenebrae.
That's
his,
great.
His return to giallo. Mm-hmm. And it's a giallo film kind of squared or something or cubed. because it's more than the original first Onslaught of the Giallos. It's got some futuristic stuff going on. You'd have to read his quotes about it. You know, in the future.
Tenebrae has a sequence of someone in a house with camera work that like has never been matched, and you're just like the stalker slasher. He just takes the POV with this girl in the house to the next level. It's and the kills and the score by Goblin. I saw a screening of it recently with Goblin playing live. That movie and Justice, the French DJs remixed the theme from Tenebrae. That song, oh, wow. Phantom. That's Justice.
Goblin rules. Gabe, what you gonna say?
There's a couple of like '80s, like early '80s ones that we didn't touch on that like are like sort of seminal. Like Happy Birthday to Me. You get like this female killer, and then you get like April Fool's Day, where it's like the thing of Muffy having and twins, Buffy. And Blood Rage had twins, right? So there was there's like that other subgenre of like the twins. But Happy Birthday to Me, I always loved as well.
Yeah, Glenn Ford, Melissa Sue Anderson.
Yeah.
Yeah, Melissa Sue Anderson.
Shish kebab.
I was going to say the shish kebab through the mouth. Yeah. What a great death that was.
That was the poster. Yeah,
yeah. I got to go, obviously, with Halloween still is my favorite if you're going for a slasher. But I'm going on left field. I still comfort food movie that I watch probably once every 4 or 5 months is Sleepaway Camp Part 2. Unhappy Campers. Is the tagline, yeah. And, of course, that's with Pamela Springsteen playing Angela Baker, and that's Bruce's sister, by the way, just in case you didn't know.
Wow.
And featuring great tits in it, promiscuous
chicks. By
the way,
Tisa Farrow stars in Anthropophagus and Zombie. That's Mia Farrow's sister.
There you go.
Yes, that's true.
But still, and we'll get to this too, with one of my favorite deaths of all time, Death by Outhouse.
Yep.
When the girl gets pushed down the outhouse and
jackass
surfaces with leeches all over her face, because obviously leeches live in the shitter of the outhouse. Basically, if you push me into an outhouse, I'm going to smell bad. I'm not going to die, and I'm not going to get eaten by leeches. It's not going to happen. Wow. That's just the way it goes. So that would be my favorite death out of any of these ones. With the runner-up, it's not necessarily a death, but an Evil Dead, where the demon pushes open the flooring and slices the damn Achilles tendon.
Yeah, the pencil.
With the pencil. Yeah, the pencil. Together. Amazing. That still grosses me out.
Well, Sam Raimi, that was one of my founding principles of horror, was hearing Sam Raimi talk about that, and he said, everybody knows what it feels like to be stabbed by a pencil, but nobody knows what it feels like to have your head chopped
off. That's a great point.
And I was like, that's been the whole principle in all the killings of the movies. Like, it's fun to watch someone get their head chopped off, but that's why I sliced the Achilles tendon in Hostel, because everybody knows, like, we've all been cut, but nobody knows what it feels like to get your head chopped off. So it's never going to be painful.
Because there is no feeling with your head chopped off. You're done.
So we think.
Oh, sure.
But people are like, no!
If you're having
this is
really
painful.
The ice is pretty slow.
If you're having your Achilles sliced by scalpels like Hostel.
Yeah, unless it's Ichi the Killer and they're slowly cutting your head
still,
off.
Still, yeah.
So the blood's rushing to it.
Still another totally gross Eli Roth moment. But favorite deaths at all? I just went through some of mine.
There was a moment where I remember watching Friday the 13th Part 5 with a Roman candle in the mouth. Looked at my friend and we were like, what? I was like, are they that out of weapons?
Well, we Roman candle. He literally just picks up a sleeping bag and slams it against
the tree.
By the way, the prophecy sleeping bag against the tree, which now is like such a cheesy death as a kid, traumatized me.
Oh, as a kid, the prophecy, yeah. How about Ron Palillo getting killed in part 6?
Yeah. Yep.
Like so they're running out of actors when Horshack
makes. Like, well, who else?
Horshack's done nothing in 20 years. Let's bring him on.
Let's bring him in.
I think he got sliced by the pole. He got like impaled by a pole. Any other good deaths?
I mean, there's the sequence in Pieces. This beautiful girl is running. She's being chased. And the guy, she knows who the killer is. Like, oh, it's you, sir. And revs the chainsaw. She goes into his stall. They run a saw like an inch from her face. The actress looks absolutely petrified because there's no safety on this set. And then right before it cuts the shot of her being chopped in half, they have a close-up of her pissing herself. And it's just the most horrible, undignified death. And I remember as a kid being like, it suddenly made the scene real. And you're watching it. It's like, oh, this isn't fun. This is like, but it's one of those little touches that, like, you never forget. Like, they did it. Like, yeah, that would happen. It's pretty accurate. So I love that movie.
Horrible.
The 80s slasher craze and another successful, amazing show with the Roth brothers and Mark.
Thanks again to Eli Roth, Gabe Roth, and Mark Goldblatt. They gave you a lot of great suggestions for slasher movies to check out. And there's even a couple I haven't seen yet, but I definitely go check them out now. I'm also going to check out Eli's new movie, Death Wish, with Bruce Willis, coming out very, very soon. I believe just in a few months. Let's play the trailer for Death Wish now.
Sway in the morning, Shay 4-5. We got to talk about what's happening in Chicago. Everybody's watching this viral video of this guy in the hoodie. They're calling the Grim Reaper. He stopped a carjacking. Is he right for taking the law into his own hands? He's become a folk hero.
What about the shooter?
He looked like a white dude.
I love my family. But when they needed me most.
911, what is your emergency?
There's men, they're breaking into my house. I think they're here.
No.
I failed to protect them.
Dad, where's Mom?
The men who did it are out there. So there's nothing that you can do? Is that what you're saying?
If a man really wants to protect what's his,
I want to buy a gun.
He has to do it for himself.
We're closed, pal.
You killed my wife!
Who else was there?
I don't know anything else.
I believe you, Joe.
So you're not gonna kill me?
No. Jack is.
You got caught in some crossfire?
The ice cream man done it.
The ice cream man?
Can't walk to school if you don't work for him.
Who are you?
The last customer.
You're not a cop!
Somebody has to do it!
Cocked, locked, and ready to rock.
I'll say.
They called him a guardian angel. He saved my life.
You look much better getting out socializing.
Not so much.
Well, whatever you're doing, keep it up.
Okay, I will.
And that comes out in a theater near you on November 22nd, 2017. So after you got your scare on today with a slasher movie extravaganza, you got to lighten things up. And that's where Team Tiger Awesome comes in. Laugh your ass off with their Ridiculoso now.
This is the news with Team Tiger Awesome. In extremely local news, the call is coming from inside the house. Authorities will not make it on time. You should run. Go. Get out. Get out now. This week in nature, some real gnarly stuff went down. This mouse was just, like, minding his own business when this rattlesnake comes up and he's all, you know what, I'll just send you guys a link. And now the pronoun index. He's pretty alright, she's in fourth place, they're stuck in third because we're in second, and you're not going to believe it's still in first place. For more news that is in no way news, listen to the Team Tiger Awesome show every Sunday on the Jericho Network, right here on Podcast One.
Team Tiger Awesome has John Morrison on the show this week to talk about Creator Wrestler 2. Remember, Timmy the Carpenter was the wrestler I created in the first installment of the series. John Morrison, Johnny Mundo will be there this week to create a wrestler, and you can get that podcast on Apple Podcasts and all iTunes areas where podcasts are available. Subscribe now. Also subscribe to all the other shows on the Jericho Network: Killing the Town, Rock Talk with Mitch LaFon, Beyond the Darkness, Raven Effect, Keeping It 100 with Conan. So many great shows. Go check it out. We're here to entertain you. Let us entertain you every single day of the week. So thank you for being here, and thanks to all the great sponsors of this episode. A&E, watch season 2 of A&E's groundbreaking docuseries, Leah Remini, Scientology in the Aftermath. New episodes every Tuesday at 9 Eastern, 8 Central on A&E, riveting show. DDP Yoga, get 20% off the DDP Yoga app and all merchandise at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Save money and time when you buy a new car or a used car at True Car. Thank you for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next, and coming up on Wednesday, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer guitar player for the Sex Pistols, and a real funny bloke. He's the host of Jonesy's Jukebox 5 days a week on KLOS in Los Angeles. I'm talking about Steve Jones, former Sex Pistols. He is going to be here on Wednesday, and what a great guy he is. We had an amazing conversation. Very funny, very cool. So check that out. Have a great weekend. And in the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!
Listen to new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.